Welcome to EV Chat. I'm your host, Rue Phillips. This show is an electric vehicle podcast with a difference. We're going to be interviewing some key players from the electric vehicle industry. Legislators, manufacturers, drivers from the street. Stick around. This is a fun kind of podcast. Today, we're going to be learning more about batteries. Moreover, batteries that power electric vehicles. Did you know that the batteries that power our EVs are literally just hundreds of little batteries, very similar to that in our laptops and smartphone devices? Our episode is going to be about lithium-ion technology and how it affects our range anxiety, reliability, and applications towards tomorrow's e-mobility and electrification plans. So stick around. I think you'll find this episode very educational. Before we start, let me introduce Dr. Nadeem Malouf, who's an engineer, entrepreneur, and a disruptive technologist who's reinventing the foundations of energy storage and mobility. He's the co-founder and CEO at QNovo, the award-winning industry pioneer in predictive battery management software that enables batteries to safely charge faster with extended longevity. He has over 30 years' experience in developing software solutions to engineer better experiences for a more resilient future and holds over 50 patents in the space. He frequently speaks at events around the world, has published numerous books and articles, and is often quoted in the media. We have a lot of brain cells on today's episode, so welcome aboard, Nadeem. So great to have you on the show. I have a feeling myself and my listeners are going to be well educated all over the globe today. So welcome aboard. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Good morning, Rue, and thank you so much for having me on board this morning. I am Nadeem Malouf. I am the CEO of QNovo. We're a company based in the Bay Area. I'm one of three co-founders of the company. I was trained classically in engineering and physics at Stanford many years ago, but I think I figured out there are folks who are way smarter than I am to do the science. So I focus more on building companies. And fundamentally, I just admire people who build products that have an impact on others. And EVs certainly has been a passion of ours.
So what got you into battery technologies?
Well, you know, about over a decade ago, I was doing a stint as a venture capitalist with a firm here in Nevada called US Venture Partners. And it was fantastic because you get to have a white sheet of paper and sort of say, hey, how would the world look like in the next 10 years? And it was evident to me at the time that we are becoming a mobile society. And mobile is a very broad term here. And in essence, for me, it translated to we're not going to be plugged to the wall anymore. We're going to be untethered. And if we're going to be untethered, that means we had to carry our energy source, our power source. And I think sort of the Star Trek fans, and I'm one of them, you know, we're not going to have any dilithium batteries anytime soon in the future. So it had to go back to lithium ion batteries. And it's like, what can we do there? So that was the first observation. The second observation was realizing that manufacturing is going to be pretty much dominating by China for the foreseeable future. So that means making the batteries themselves was not going to be something that we're going to be successful at least in the short term. And that kind of led us down the path of, can we do more intelligence around the battery? And that's kind of how we got to where we are today. Fast forward, and it's amazing what the world has done in the last 10 years. Batteries 10 years ago were like, what? Lithium ion, what? And today it's like EVs are almost everywhere. Not quite, but getting there. So super exciting.
So I've been dying to ask this question. Explain to us how lithium ion batteries operate in cars versus our laptop, our cell phones. What's the difference?
Indeed. So if you don't mind, I'm going to step back and kind of focus more on just how a lithium ion battery works, independent of the use case, independent of whether it's in a car or in a truck or in a smartphone. And in a very simplistic mental picture, think of two porous layers. and I'm talking very, very close apart. You know, we're talking micrometers apart. And you've got ions, lithium ions, literally lithium ions are very tiny, and they're shuffling back and forth between one and the other material. So when you charge, they go from one end to the other, and when they discharge, it's the opposite path. So that's essentially what you have in your smartphone today, one of those. In a car, you've got about 3,000 of those. A Tesla Model 3 has got 3,000 of them. So in essence, it's just quantity. Now, of course, I'm really simplifying. Growth is simplifying. There are variances on the materials that are used. So the material that's used in the phone is a little different than the material that's actually in the car. But the fundamentals are the same.
That's interesting, Nadim, because I worked in solar for a while. And the differences between a 50-megawatt plant and a 5-kilowatt plant are not that vast. You have a series of solar panels and you have an inverter. In the bigger plants, you just have more solar panels and a bigger inverter. So you're saying it is basically like thousands of cell phone batteries in my electric vehicle.
Pretty much, yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, early days of Tesla, if you go back to the Roadster back in 2007, I think, nobody remembers that anymore. And so Tesla was early in its days, and they said, hey, I need batteries. And they looked around and was like, well, nobody made EV batteries. And so they went and got batteries from the Panasonic laptops, which is why Panasonic today is the incumbent supplier to Tesla. Because way, way back in 2006, they said, hey, take my laptop batteries and build up the Roadster out of it. And they put, I think at the time, like 8,000 laptop batteries to make the Tesla Roadster.
Interesting. So in that sense, then, if there was a failure in a battery pack, could it not be that there's a failure in just a few of those tens of thousands of batteries?
Or even just one.
Or even just one.
Absolutely. So now you're getting into the details of engineering. That's exactly right. So if a phone dies, well, you know, you go to the store, you replace the battery, you replace the phone. But one battery dies in the vehicle, that's far more complex. Certainly accessing the battery is very difficult. It can lead to safety issues if one of them gets overheated. So every car company has got their own measures of how you contain potential failures. Or even better yet, how do you prevent the failure to happening? So today, smartphones don't have all those precautions in place, but EVs do. They have much more sophistication. And that's kind of what we do in partly, putting that intelligence around the battery that sort of says, how do I prevent a failure? And in that remote event, there is a failure, how do we contain it so it's actually taken out of circulation before it leads to a hazard? So these are all the various intelligence layers that need to be put in the car and makes the car where it is today as an EV ready to be deployed. Along with that, of course, is how do, when you put 8,000 laptops, the question of cost. How do I manage the cost of that many batteries? And so that's a lot of work that's happening in that sector.
Interesting. So range anxiety. Let's talk about range anxiety, which is the big fear for most people that want to buy an electric vehicle, or maybe they won't buy an electric vehicle because of the range. What can be done about it, and where do we see the technology? And moreover, what's your company doing about this?
Well, I have a lot of anxiety to begin with, so I think that really meshes well with mine. So let's talk about range first. Most combustion engine vehicles have a range of roughly 400 miles today in the US. EVs, certainly the most recent modern EV crops, somewhere under 300, 350. So the range difference between the two EVs and combustion engine is not that vast. And so that begs the question, where's the anxiety coming from? And the anxiety comes from the fact that we have uncertainty around the charging. When you buy a combustion engine vehicle, you know where the gas station is. And you know how fast you can fill up. And you know that when you go to the gas station, it's only a remote chance that it may not be up so you can fill up. That is not true yet for EVs. You don't know where the charging stations are. You may or may not. And if you go there, there's a chance that it may be down. Or perhaps there's a line. And you may not have access to the charging. And that's essentially the uncertainty is creating a lot of anxiety. And it's not a problem that cannot be solved. It is being solved. I think I go back to sort of, you know, I wasn't alive, but sort of go back to the 20s and the 30s of the last century. And I don't think gas stations were everywhere. So if you drove a car, you kind of had the same issue. And ultimately, we resolved that. And I think there are two components to resolving the range anxiety, and both of which are actually in play as we speak. The first one is you've got to get the EV to charge fast. You know, sort of 45 minutes or an hour to charge the EV is just not possible anymore. I mean, if you're charging in the garage, your garage, that's perfectly fine. But if you're in a dense urban area, you don't have the luxury of dangling a cord from the 10th story balcony. And so you have to go to a charging station and you need to charge in about, you know, call it 20 minutes. And that's the first thing that we do at Qnova, sort of how do you enable an EV to charge in 20 minutes or thereabout, even less. And now it's getting close to the, not identical, but awfully close to the charging experience or the fill-up experience of a combustion engine. The second component of that is making sure that we have charging stations everywhere. So when you're driving and you can pull in and you can charge seamlessly, you don't have to fumble through your credit card and sort of say, wait a second, what network is this thing and what credit card does it take? And is it up and running? These are all the questions that are being resolved. I believe that in the next 2 or 3 years, we'll see tremendous progress on the charging experience. And that's going to begin to reduce and mitigate the anxiety that we just talked about.
That's really, really interesting. So the anxiety is not in the car, it's in the infrastructure.
Indeed. Well, partly in the car, because even if you had the infrastructure and the car could not accept the charge at the rate that you want it to be, and means charging in 20 minutes or less, you're going to sit there for an hour. And trust me, if you live in the Northeast or perhaps in the Midwest in a cold winter day, you don't want to be sitting outside for 45 minutes.
So that said, though, Nadim, what do you think we can expect to see as far as a range by 2030?
I think 400 miles is going to be the sweet spot.
Okay.
And there are a couple of reasons for that one. One, that's sort of historically what we've seen out of combustion engines, and people are comfortable with 400 miles. Mm-hmm. And that kind of really is a good range to get you from sort of a major metropolitan area to another one. Say Los Angeles to San Francisco, roughly 400 miles. That's good enough. But also the other factor is that the cost of the vehicle is predominantly the battery's cost. You know, the battery today is about 40, sometimes 50% the cost of the EV. And so more range means more battery. More battery means more cost. And that's sort of a vicious circle. And so look at the Lucid Air. It's a beautiful vehicle, 500 miles of range, but it's got a ginormous battery and it's super expensive. And so I think part of our task also globally and at Qnova is how do we make EVs affordable and really expand that reach to almost all the strata of society and not just simply to the affluent portion.
So let's talk about the lifetime of batteries, Nadim. Is it down to the cycles? When I mean the cycles to the listener is how many times you charge the car, or is it the way you drive the car, which kind of predicts the lifetime of the battery pack?
I would say 95% is due to charging cycles and 5% the way you drive it. And obviously, if you mistreat the car, it's going to mistreat you back and you're going to have other issues. But if you drive normally and you're not excessively abusing the vehicle, and by that I'm putting, you know, high temperatures or perhaps hot, cold weathers or driving recklessly, by and large, you're talking about cycles. And to be clear for the audience here, cycle essentially is a bit of a ill-defined term. It sort of says, not every time you plug in, it's a cycle. Mm-hmm. It essentially says, I need to go from zero charge in the battery to 100% charge in the battery and then back down to zero. That's 100%. That's one cycle. Nobody drives like that. Nobody waits until you're down to zero and you go fill up. We're often sort of fill up at maybe 20, 30% and seldom go to 100%. We'll go to 80%. So essentially now you got 50% in one charge and it takes two of those to make one cycle. So it's a bit of a combination of a bit of a math here that's unnecessary headache for the users. But that's sort of roughly where the math is, mostly cycles. The easiest way to think about it is you can convert cycles to miles. And so one charge cycle is one full tank in the vehicle, and that's roughly 300 miles. So the easiest way to think about it is one cycle equals 300 miles. So if I drive this over 10 years, 150,000 miles, that's about 500 cycles. And that's typically what you'd expect from the modern EVs, not the ones that are 5, 6, 7 years ago, but the modern ones that are being launched today by the various car makers are roughly 500 cycles. And people expect, and the test and the data that we have shows that after 500 miles or 500 cycles and 150,000 miles, you'd expect to get roughly about 90% of what you had on day one in terms of capacity. So if on day one you had a range of 300 miles, after those 10 years, 150,000 miles, you'll get about 90% of that range, which is 270 miles. And that's really exceptional. That's fantastic. For a vehicle that old, that's really good.
So here's a common question. Should we really be topping up the battery pack? If we're at 80%, say, should we even be plugging in the car just for that 20% top up?
The short answer is no.
Okay.
And by the way, that applies to any kind of battery operated system. My iPhone is 5 years old. I'm so proud of my old iPhone. And the battery is still absolutely superb in it because unless I'm traveling, I don't top it off. And so in the EV, if you're just simply doing errands around town, don't top it off. Now, naturally, that begs the question, why should the driver be thinking about these things? And that's where Qnovo comes in. We're saying, look, let me take care of all those things for you. You shouldn't be worried about that. You should just hop in the car and drive. We'll take care of the rest for you. But if you really want to feel like you want to be in control of the charging process and the battery's longevity, by all means, unless you're doing a long trip and you're driving, you need all the miles in the tank, don't top it off. And then you will have excessive longevity. I mean, you could go to 400,000 miles on the batteries and you'd be just perfectly fine.
Interesting. Thanks for that. So public infrastructure versus charging at home. You know, in the UK, everyone says, well, we don't have enough public chargers. And this is going to be the actual Achilles heel for the industry. And my argument is, well, most people, if they have the facilities, of course, will be charging at home. Where do you see the adoption? Would you advise public infrastructure or home charging?
I don't think it's one or the other. It's going to be both. I think it's a mix of both. And you have, you know, we've got, what, 8-9 billion people on the planet. Not all of them have garages and access to a home charging facility. So certainly if you live in suburban or rural areas, it makes a lot of sense for you to charge at home. But if you live in dense urban areas in New York City or central London or Shanghai or Beijing, it's really, really hard to do that. And more of our societies are becoming more urbanized and essentially says, I don't have a garage. I can't do home charging. And that basically says we need to have a charging infrastructure. The other thing is also in the big, dense urban areas, say San Francisco, and it's a city very close to us. What are you going to do with the old gas stations? It's a natural play for the companies like Shell and Chevron and BP and what have you to transform these fill-up stations into charging stations. And that makes it more accessible, therefore, for those who live in the dense urban areas to access these fill-up stations. The cost also may be more favorable in some cases for fill-up stations, or in this case, for your charging stations. Commercial vehicles, these also cannot be charging at home. These are big batteries, so they need to have their own charging infrastructure. So I think that'll be ultimately a mix. Today, you see a lot of exploration of both. Some folks are promoting some degree of home charging and some capabilities of how you charge, of how you put the energy back onto the grid. Others are saying, look, let's experiment with different models for the infrastructure. It is not cheap to build the charging infrastructure. It's very expensive. Now, the good news is that in the U.S., we've got a lot of incentives from the government to promote that. And you got companies that are thinking about different and clever business models. The recent announcements, of course, from GM and Ford to adopt the Tesla charging infrastructure and the Tesla standards. That also is very important to streamline from a driving standpoint, from the driver's perspective. How do you streamline the experience? So I don't get to a charging station and say, wait a second, I can't fill up because the nozzle is different. I mean, imagine going to a gas station today and the nozzle in the gas station doesn't fit in the gas tank. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. So we talk about public infrastructure here in the U.S. I founded one of the largest operations and maintenance companies for service technicians for the renewable energy sector for solar. As far as operations and maintenance on public infrastructure, do you think we're there? On a scale of 1 to 10, what would you give our present infrastructure score, Nadim?
It depends on the geography. I think here in the Bay Area, I would probably say 6, maybe 7. Mm-hmm. You leave the Bay Area, 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
It's dismal. I mean, no, I think it's where you see cars being sold. There's the incentive to build out the infrastructure. Tesla has done a fabulous job for their own network. You get out of Tesla's network, the score drops drastically. You leave into different states within the country and you have a fairly low score. Europe has done a great job. I mean, certainly Europe has got a very EV-friendly regulatory environment, and they've been doing building up more. China has done a fabulous job building up the infrastructure. So you get a patchwork of different geographies. But you go to India, you go to Africa, and it's like, EV, what's that?
Yeah.
They're getting better. They're building up. They're investing. But they've got work to do.
Now, you mentioned scoring on availability. What about reliability? That's getting bad press right now as far as
indeed.
We have infrastructure in place, but is it reliable? What's your point on that?
The numbers right now are not very promising. I think when it comes to reliability outside of the Tesla network, the numbers need some significant improvements. And 90% may sound like a big number, but it's not good enough. That means 1 out of 10 stations are down. And that's not what you want. I mean, this is 1 out of 10 gas stations being down. That creates a massive headache for drivers, and if not, sometimes a crisis. And so I think we need to do better. We need to be at 99%+ of reliability uptime. And that's going to take more time. It's going to take investment. The question mark today is about who's going to pay for that. Building those fill-up stations, the charging stations, is not cheap. Just to give you a perspective, you know, putting one DC fast charging station in the ground is roughly $300,000, maybe even more, maybe close to $500,000. Wow. So you put one of those 10 charging stations onto one fill-up stations, and that's millions of dollars. Who's paying for that? How do you recoup that? It's not just the price of the electricity. Often we think about, I want to go fill up and I'll pay for the electricity. But there's the infrastructure, and that needs to be captured. We haven't done that yet.
Yeah, got it. Now, we've been talking about lithium-ion batteries. Are there any other technologies that we should be looking for?
Many promising materials are in the pipeline. But ultimately, if you think about lithium-ion, that was invented in 19, or at least perhaps brought to production by Sony in 1996. So here we are, what's 27 years later that we see this in mass production. Building up materials is costly, and it takes a lot of time. And so will these promising innovations hit the market in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years? I'm very skeptical. 10 years, 15 years, maybe. But today, I think it's lithium ion for the foreseeable future. And it's fundamentally, the issue is about how do you bring the price point down? You know, today, a battery in an EV is called 100 kilowatt hours. That's about over $10,000, the cost of the battery. That's expensive. And so how do we bring it down to half that price point? And so it's the innovation. A lot of innovation is going into mass manufacturing batteries that can be produced at a fairly low cost.
Talking about innovation, let's talk about Qnova. Tell us a little bit about your company.
So at Qnova, we figured that there's a lot that can be done by layering intelligence on top of the battery. So there's a lot of cool stuff that the battery does. But the intelligence essentially can open up much more capabilities and performance and safety that you couldn't do just with materials. And part of the inspiration sort of came from photography. If you're a photographer, you may remember the old DSLRs, and they're kind of bulky, and you paid thousands of dollars for the lens. And then all of a sudden comes the iPhone and the smartphone, and with a $2 plastic lens, and all of a sudden they're making those amazing pictures. And that innovation essentially shifted the burden from the expensive optics manufacturing to computation. And computation is very cheap today because you've got very sophisticated computers in a very small footprint that can do a lot of stuff. And that's kind of what we do with our solutions. Take batteries and with computation, expand the envelope. For example, we can do fast charging. We enable very, very fast charging, 20 minutes or less. We can do that without damaging the battery. And that's due to computation, kind of the softwares that we do. How do you ensure safety? We talked about safety earlier on. What if one battery failed? We can distinguish that one battery that may potentially fail weeks and weeks in advance. And therefore, instead of having a very expensive recall and having cars catching fire, you can isolate that one battery, that one vehicle, and do the maintenance on it. So that's a whole layer of sophistication that sits on top of the battery and gives the driver more range, more cost, faster charging, reliability, and safety.
Interesting. Predictive algorithms. And oh my gosh, yes, that's awesome. That's where I see the future, Nadim. It's, you know, our smart devices. Someone is going to know that that device is going to break down sometime in the future based on its performance and its history. And I'm excited about. Now, let's talk about the future. Bidirectional, V2G, V2X, V2Everything. Explain a little bit about that bidirectional technology.
Yeah, first let me perhaps explain what it really means, V to X, vehicle to whatever, to something. That means today when you take the vehicle somewhere to a charging station, the power flows from the charging station to the vehicle. And so when you say V to G, that means now I want the power flow to go from the vehicle back to the grid. So I am powering the grid. And that's a very interesting concept. And there are multiple layers of interest to the end users. One is V to home. So can I power my home with my vehicle? And you're seeing more and more vehicles doing that. So I think perhaps the most prominent one is the Ford F-150 Lightning. It's got a gigantic battery and you could power your home for a whole week based out of it. Essentially, it's fantastic. So back to your PV past rule, you could, in principle, put solar panels on your home, charge your F-150 Lightning in the daytime, and then power your home at night, and then completely be off the grid. And that's fantastic. People love it. So these are use cases that I think at the individual level. Now, the V2G now says, hey, I'm not going to power my home anymore. I want to power the grid. I want to power my neighbor's home and next block and the next block. Now it gets more complicated. In principle, the power flow can happen, but how can the utility manage all those variables? Imagine you've got 15 cars on the block and they're all sending power back to the grid. And the utility says, ooh, what do I do with that? And you've seen this on the PV side when all of a sudden we had PV solar panels on everybody's roof. And the utility says, what do I do with the excess power? And so that takes a lot more coordination. Europe is much more advanced than we are in that respect. They have regulation that begins to put in place the models, the business models, the ability to take that power back from the vehicles and use it effectively on the grid. The US is beginning to learn on that one. So that's sort of we're beginning to do V2G. But in principle, it allows us to have distribution of power. So instead of having a central power plant, in principle, now you can store that battery power in various vehicles across the city or the town and reutilize that in times of the need, which is really evening time or perhaps when the sun has set or the wind has come down. Now, the V2X is sort of a bit of a V2, I don't know what. You know, I'm going to power something, but I don't know what. And that's an interesting term for the future. But ultimately, right now, I think it's a V2 home and V2 grid where it makes sense. And we'll see more of that in the coming 5 years or so, maybe 10 years. Europe is more advanced. I think I'd love to sort of see those cases proven in Europe. And then the US can begin to adopt these.
So we're seeing more and more of the integration of electric vehicles, battery energy storage, and solar PV. I'm slightly frustrated about the technology, whereas we have a DC solar system on the roof, which is converted to AC to charge a battery, which is DC, which may be a battery energy storage pack, which is DC. So we've got this conversion. Tell me, are we going to have a common DC bus anywhere in the near future?
There may be. I think ultimately it's because you're powering your home, which is running AC. So your appliances are AC. So at some point in time, you need to have a conversion back to AC. But your point is well taken. Do I need two inverters? One at the battery side and one on the PV side? And the answer is probably not. I can probably live with one and then have that output to the house. But the evolution of storage in the home is still early. I mean, you've seen Tesla, of course, spearhead that with their Powerwall batteries. In principle, you can replace it with the vehicle, the car. Now, the car already has an inverter in it anyway. It converts to AC anyway. And so you have one there. You've got one at the solar panels. You've got also inverters. You got another one in there. So the question is, can we be more efficient and reduce the number of inverters? I think that's an innovation that sort of hasn't happened yet. I think that requires home integration. And home integration is still, I would say, years away before we have standards.
Interesting. Yeah, I look forward to that. I really do. Let's talk about recycling. You know, I'm starting to see more and more recycling in solar panels even right now. Where are we going with that? Is there a second use for a semi-depleted battery pack, Nadim?
Indeed. So I think there are two components to that question. First one is really about what do I do with batteries that still have something left in them? So we talked about batteries in EVs, 500 cycles, they still have 90% of the battery capacity. What can I do with that? And that's what's called second life or nth life, you know, whatever, however many lives that you think you can get out of it. And there's actually potential market for that one. There's a lot of cool stuff happening in there. There aren't yet enough batteries that are kind of gone through the lives in the EVs that are taken out. These are mostly kind of leaf batteries and some old generation batteries, and these are mostly not ready for second life. But The ones that are today in the market, whether it's Tesla or VW or others, yeah, these actually are very good candidates for Second Life. And we're going to expect to see some of those being taken out of vehicles in the next few years and being put in energy storage systems. So you may get a lower cost energy storage system, either at the grid level, or utility level, or perhaps at your home, that essentially is a reused car battery. Now, what happens when the battery now is fully depleted? And depleted usually is about 80% roughly. So it's not 100% all the way down to zero. It's 100% down to 80% of the initial capacity. At 80%, the battery now is deemed unusable anymore. So you are not allowed to put it in anything. Heck, you can't even ship it because no shipper will ever take a battery that's deemed used or depleted. At that point in time, one or two things happen. Ideally, it's going to be recycled. We're not there yet. There's a lot of innovation taking place in recycling. We should be able to get to the point where we economically take all the components out. The materials that are in the lithium-ion battery can be taken out in pieces, the cobalt, the nickel, the magnesium, the graphite, etc., and separated in a way that we can do it economically. Today, it can be done, but it's not economically yet. If you think about the lead-acid battery in the vehicle, in the combustion engine today, 99.9% of that battery gets recycled economically today, especially the lead. We're making strides towards the equivalent recycling in the lithium-ion batteries. But there's also important drivers for that one. I mean, you were asking the question about 2030 earlier. On the path that we're on right now, we're going to need to put 600 new mines in the ground by 2030 to meet the demands of EVs. So if we can recycle, that's probably another 10, 15, 20% of those mines that don't need to happen. And then to sort of add one more little plug about Qinovo, by extending the usable life of the battery, so back to the longevity, so if I can go from 500 cycles to 1,000 cycles, that's fewer batteries that I need to actually put back in recycling or put back depleted batteries, and therefore I can essentially leverage that to have fewer mines that we need to put in the ground in the next 6 years.
That's really, really fascinating. I'm going to go invest in mines right now, lithium mining.
Absolutely. Latin America.
Okay, you got it. So let's talk about safety. You know, years back when the early Fisker Karma came out, it had a problem. I guess the battery pack was really low. And when it went through flooded water, some of the cars caught fire. I'm a glass half full. I am really gung-ho for the technology. Talk to us about some of the safety concerns.
Indeed. I mean, battery fires are not unique to Fisker. They've happened in laptops. You know, Sony factory burnt down way back in 2003, I think, the whole factory, because of battery fires. A year and a half ago, you had GM, the Chevy Bolt, that also burned down. You had Hyundai with the Kona. They had fires, and they were very expensive recalls. But the good news, and I think I'm with you 100%, there's optimism to believe that these problems can be resolved. Solutions like ours and many others, you can predict exactly what particular cell in what particular car can potentially lead to fire. And that one vehicle, which is responsible often for big recalls, can be taken out of circulation early on, and that battery taken out and replaced as a maintenance call. So these technologies are in play. You're going to see potentially more regulations from the government that will say you must have technologies like that. You cannot just simply drive a car that may catch fire. That notion of may catch fire is not okay. And so you see a term in the industry called zero events. Zero events means no fires at all. And so I think we're easily within a year or two of reaching that point.
That's awesome. And I think the listener should be looking out for Qinovo, how you're going to be helping that reliability, safety, and efficiency. That's great news.
Look for Qinovo Insight.
Yeah. Exactly, yes. So let's talk non-technical. What EV are you driving? Are you driving an EV?
I was driving a Ford EV. Now I'm waiting for the next crop. I know what's coming down the pike with our solutions on them in 2024. So I'm going to leave that as a surprise. I'll let you know next year what EV I'm driving so you can go buy a version of that one.
But fantastic.
These are going to be super exciting cars with very fast charging, high reliability, longevity, and excellent range. And I think that's the point where we feel like the EV is becoming awfully close to the experience of a combustion engine.
Fantastic, fantastic. So if you were in charge of the funds with billions of dollars that's been allocated by the Biden administration, where would you be putting that money, Nadim?
Oh, my goodness. That's a tough question. That's a trick question, Ruth, because I'm not in government. We are in touch. The good news that we are in touch with the various government officials and the DOT, ARPA-E, which is the Department of Energy, the various agencies and the governments that are really responsible for doling out so these funds. I think, to a large extent, the dialogue is happening, which is fantastic. We'd love to see that there's more dialogue encompassing various types of technologies. The safety, I think, is super important. We're seeing, for example, NHTSA, Department of Transportation, putting a lot of emphasis on predictive safety. EPA is getting involved. Also, electrifying commercial vehicles is another big one. Passenger cars are important, but commercial vehicles are equally important because you have a lot of emissions from those, and we're very involved in that sector too, on either Class 8, these are the heavy-duty vehicles. Light commercial vehicles is another one. Also, I think you're seeing for the first time in years where the U.S. government is sort of saying, yes, we do want to manufacture batteries here onshore, but there's a lot more to batteries than just simply manufacturing batteries. And I love that argument. That's fantastic. That was not the case 5 or 7, 8 years ago. We were myopic 5, 7 years ago, where we focused pretty much the vast majority of our funds on just how do we bring manufacturing onshore. Yes, it's important, but it's incomplete.
You know, sadly, we've come to the end of this show, Nadim, but how could people reach you if they've got questions and they want to find out more about your company?
www.qnovo.com, Q-N-O-V-O.com. We'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Everything is on site.
Awesome. It's been an honor and a pleasure to be educated by you. And I'm sure our listeners across the globe would agree with me on that. You've been a great guest, Nadim. Thank you so much. Come and talk to us again sometime in the future.
I would love to, Ruth. Thanks for having me again. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Yes, sadly indeed, we've come to the end of today's show. Next time you plug in your smartphone or your laptop, maybe you'll think about plugging in your next car, a smart vehicle, an electric car. I hope you enjoyed the show. Last week, we surpassed 50,000 listeners, and we're reaching thousands of EV enthusiasts from all over the globe. If you want to reach out to me, you can contact me at Roo Phillips on LinkedIn. You may also want to consider joining our EV Infrastructure Forum, again on LinkedIn. We have over 7,000 members. It's a great forum for networking and also learning more about the industry. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, use the same contact information. We'd love to hear from you. We look forward to having you on the next episode. Until then, ciao.